are listening to the new voice of Conservative Talk Radio. Unafraid and aggressive, he will take on anyone, including Republicans. This is Aaron McCready. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also, follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready and visit him on the web at aaronmccready.com.
Well, we are all here set up and ready to go. It's great to be with you tonight. We have got a lot to talk about, and I am very excited about tonight's show. Coming up in just a few minutes, we have Karna Small Bodman. As many of you know, and you've heard her here before, she is an author, a former news anchor, and also worked in the White House for President Ronald Reagan. But before we get to her in just a minute, I'm going to give you a rundown of what we will be talking about. Of course, we've got Karna coming on in just a second. But we're also going to talk about President Assad, the Syrian president. He had an interview with Fox News today, and we're going to be dissecting that a little bit later on and talking about that. This man, he reminds me a lot of Saddam Hussein and how he uses his wording. He very vague. You really have to read between the lines with this man to really understand what he's talking about, and don't take him at face value. We're also going to be talking about Iran, Russia, Syria, Barack Obama, of course. An episode would not be complete without talking about the president. But, again, I'm excited, very excited about tonight's show. Joining me live from Washington, D.C., is Karna Small Bodman. Karna was Deputy Press Secretary for President Reagan and then became Senior Director and Spokesman for the National Security Council. Karna is also an author, writing political thrillers, and her latest book, Castle Bravo, was a finalist for the 2013 Indie Book Awards and won an award at the Paris Book Festival. Karna, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you so much. Delighted to be with you tonight.
Well, it's great to have you on. Really quick, and I spoke that you worked for President Reagan. And, you know, one thing that drives me just up the wall when I listen, especially around election time, and listen to some politicians, is they brag and boast about knowing President Reagan when, in fact, they may have only had one meeting with him or just had a photo op. But, you know, you had just about daily meetings with the president, flew on Air Force One, briefed him on intelligence issues. So you know, you actually knew him. You're the real deal. And I guess a question I have for you is, you know, looking at our current president and what a great leader Ronald Reagan was, what are we lacking, in your opinion, that we so desperately need now with this president that Ronald Reagan had?
Well, let me quote, if I could, start off on a, well, I don't want to make light of this because your question is an extremely good one, but let me tell you a personal experience just recently. I happened to attend a private party. This was just before the last election, and Chris Christie was there, okay, Governor of New Jersey.
Right.
And Christie was, well, he can be a pretty funny guy. You know, he's a very, very loquacious, very friendly kind of person. And so in any event, he was talking about Obama. Of course, he was helping the Romney campaign, as we all know. Anyway, in the course of some of his remarks, he made this comment, and I wanted to make a point to remember it because I thought it was a pretty good line. Here's what he said. He said, you know, I feel sorry for Obama because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. He's a man fumbling in the dark, searching for the light switch of leadership.
Oh, wow.
That's it, right there, in a nutshell,
right,
from Chris Christie about Barack Obama. And I think we've seen that play out just recently. We've seen it not just recently. We've seen it for the last several years, the man not leading, particularly in the foreign policy field. And there's so many comparisons we could make between Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, How much time have you got here?
we have as much time as you need. You know, one thing I was, you know, before you came on, I was looking it up and just to see, you know, what struggles Reagan had before he became president, you know, when he took the oath of office, and the same thing with Obama when he took the oath of office. And, you know, Obama, you know, brags sometimes that, you know, well, I wouldn't say brag, that's not the right word, but, you know, the condition of the country when he took it and, you know, how it came along. But then you look at Ronald Reagan, and in 1980, unemployment was 7.2%, but when Obama took office in 2008, it was only 5.8%. Inflation in 1980 was 13.5% when Reagan took office, and in 2008 it was 3.8. So, you know, you compare the
two. And there's
two
one
like
other,
that.
Exactly, and there's one other. Let's just add to it, and that is Reagan was fighting in the beginning 21.5% interest rates. Now,
right.
Try buying a car or house or washing machine or just about anything in those days, and it is so interesting. To see, now, granted, Obama came in tough times. I mean, okay, we know that. We grant that. However, there is an interesting comparison, as you say, and the two people had entirely different approaches, really, to the idea of restoring the economy. Now, let's look back. Reagan put forth a program. First of all, he said, okay, we're going to cut taxes. Now, when he came in, the highest tax rate was 70%. A lot of deductions, but, I mean, that was a rate. When he left, it was 28%. A few ups and downs here and there, but that's what it was. The first thing he did was try to put through a 25% cut in marginal tax rates, and he got it through a Democratic Congress. Made a few deals here and there, but he got it through.
Right.
And this was not just for the lower-down people or just lower the middle income, whatever. This was across the board, of course, lower, middle, upper income, job creators, everybody. And it was very interesting because one only has to look at history to say what works and what doesn't work. And when we have had tax cuts across the board for everyone, particularly job creators, which Obama eschews, he says, absolutely not, those rich people have to pay more, it's terrible. But when we've had them across the board, even going back as far as the Kennedy tax cuts, what happens is more and more people are working because people create more jobs. Reagan created 18 million new jobs, depending on what day you start counting. And revenues, ever since the Kennedy tax cuts, increased into the government. In fact, under Reagan, with more economic activity, more people working, revenues actually doubled into the government. Now, you see, people say, well, he ran a bit of a deficit. Well, on the other hand, he was building up our defenses, and he had a Democratic Congress to spend a lot of money. But when all of his reforms filtered through the economy, eventually those deficits were absolutely removed, as we know, in subsequent administrations, whereas Obama has racked up another $6 trillion in debt. You know, while he's been in office, things are going up and up and up. A couple other comparisons for you, Aaron, and knowing I was going to be on your show, I looked up a few, too. You say, what else? 18 million new jobs. Okay, that's cool. But who benefited? Probably just all those rich guys, right, under Reagan? Well, no. As a matter of fact, what happened was other groups benefited tremendously. Black unemployment fell under Reagan by 20%. Now, under Obama, it's increased by 42%.
I want to ask you one question on that real quick. I'll give you one more.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to give you one more. Teenage unemployment under Reagan dropped by 16%. Now, under Obama, it is increased by an incredible 56%. The kids don't have jobs.
Well, one question I have on that, and you talked about the black unemployment. You know, I believe that, you know, a lot of politicians, their number one job is to get reelected. And, you know, with the Democrats, you know, they like big government. And, I believe that they like to, expand government, make more people rely on government so they can get reelected. And do you think that's why perhaps that black unemployment has risen with Obama, because he wants more people to rely on government. Government has control over everything, so that more Democrats can get reelected, whereas Reagan wanted, you know, people to be free, to have more money, to go out and spend, and like you said, you know, the revenues to the government increased because of that. I mean,
Right. The thing is, I think it's a combination of things under Obama. You know, mainly, you have not had an increase in job creation. Oh, he says there's been some part-time jobs and this and that, but not enough to keep up with population growth, people getting out of school and looking for jobs and all the rest. And it's just been tragic. I'm sure it's hit people you know, families we know, people in our family have had tough times losing jobs, trying to find other jobs, that sort of thing. And the thing is, when you raise taxes on upper income job creators, they don't have the extra money to create more jobs. It's just so obvious. I just don't know how he can't grasp this.
Right.
And
who's been hired?
I mean, it's such a shame. It is just
been
such
hired
a shame.
What I was going to say is who's been in, you know, hired by a poor person? You know what I mean?
It's really tough. I mean, he will argue that if you give more money to lower economic folks, then they will go out and buy a refrigerator, and that'll put the refrigerator makers back to work. Unfortunately, that isn't the way it works. If you give them more money, but you don't know whether it's going to continue, people will try to save it or get themselves a little bit out of debt. It just doesn't work. What works is to get government out of your lives, as Reagan used to say, unleash the entrepreneurial spirit of America and American workers. And I think a lot of people do want to work. Certainly, yes, there are people that are dependent on government, and I think that there is an underlying feeling of, well, let's help those people by the Obama administration and get them more dependent, because then they'll vote for us. But I do think there are a lot of lower-income folks who desperately want a job and are just almost giving up. I mean, it's really, really sad. Now, there's another aspect to this, too, and that is, in addition to the whole job creation idea and tax cuts, when Reagan was in, one of his other planks to get the economy moving was to cut regulations, and he talked about it all the time. You know, get government out of your life, as I just said. When he came in, the numbers were this. There were 87,000 pages of regulations in the Federal Register. That's where they keep track of those things. When Reagan left, there were about 40,000 pages. You know, heck of a cut. I mean, unbelievable.
Oh, sure.
Now it's way, way up there again, you know, way over 100,000 pages. I mean, every administration since Reagan, of course, has added their regs of one sort or another, which is too bad. But it's exploded under President Obama. In fact, even the Washington Post had an analysis that showed that just Obamacare alone has added another 20,000 pages of regulations of one sort or another. So in this kind of an uncertain environment with government making people wondering what in the world is coming next, sure, businesses have cut back. They've cut back on hours. They're not hiring people. It's just added to the mix. And it also means that there's hundreds of billions of dollars in compliance costs, you know, and that means that businesses can't really expand. They're filling out too much paperwork. You know, it's really too bad. So all of these things have contributed to the fact that we do not have a bustling economy. In fact, it's been the worst recovery in 80 years. You know, under Reagan, you can also, another measure is growth in GDP. When Reagan's tax cuts filtered through and started to work in the economy, we started seeing 3% growth, then 4% growth, and at one point even 7% growth in GDP. What do we have today? Less than 2.
Oh, sure.
It's just pathetic, absolutely pathetic.
Well, and you know, he talks about, and I'm talking about Obama, you know, creating so many jobs, but with, I guess, am I right or wrong with, you know, the way government is growing, a good portion of those jobs that he's created are just governmental jobs. It really doesn't affect the private sector.
He's really increased the government workforce. Let me give you one little tiny vignette here. Under Reagan, when I worked on the National Security Council staff, we had the professional staff people, not the secretaries or administrative folks, but just professional staff who were, say, in charge of the Soviet affairs or European affairs or you know, political or military. You know, we had 40 staff people, okay, on the NSC staff. Obama has 284. I don't know where those people park. I don't know where they have lunch. There isn't space for them in the White House mess. I mean, I don't know what they do. And then there's something else. Obama's had a very unique way of getting people in place in responsible jobs, I guess, that normally you would think would have to have Senate confirmation, like cabinet members, okay, mm-hmm. who make policy decisions and so forth. But Obama's found a way to get around that. Now, let me put it in perspective. Do some more research for you. Russia had 22 czars over history. They served over a period of 400 years, one at a time. Mm-hmm. Obama named close to 30 White House czars in his first 2 years, and I have no idea what those people do, and they're not confirmed by the Senate.
Wow.
Just a little item for you there.
Well, just big government run amok, you know. One question I do want to get to your book, Castle Bravo, in a moment.
Sure.
And you know, connect that with what's going on in the world today. But, mm-hmm. you know, like I said earlier, you knew Ronald Reagan. And what, you know, we saw him, you know, on TV as our president. But behind closed doors, what really concerned him? You know, we see the political side, but with America and what the man, Ronald Reagan, what really concerned him?
Well, a number of things. I mean, I don't pretend to be a Reagan biographer. I did see him quite a bit. I saw him in meetings, and I saw him in small groups quite a bit, and all of that. But first of all, the man had principles. He believed in America. He believed in American exceptionalism, regardless of what Putin might write in the New York Times. He believed that we were a special country endowed by our creators. He believed in the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. He believed in free enterprise, which in effect is the enterprise of free men, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in trying to spread freedom around the world. He talked about it all the time. And he believed that our system of democracy was really the best one, that had brought the best standard of living anywhere in the world, which is true. Just
mm-hmm.
look around. And yet he also knew that there was evil in the world. I mean, here's a man who, you know, lived through World War II. He saw all kind, you know, other wars, you know, Korea, Vietnam, everything else. He saw all those things. He cared deeply about our military, tremendous concerns. He was at Dover Air Force Base when they would bring our boys back, you know, who had died and all that sort of thing.
Right.
He felt very strongly. But mainly, he knew that America had to be strong and had to be a strong leader in the world, because if not, who else would be that had
right.
our values of freedom and democracy? And when you talk about leadership, which we did at the outset there, about, I think, a lack of leadership on the part of the current White House occupant, let me give you one little story that happened early on. And it wasn't a foreign policy story. It was a domestic story. And this was really early in the first year of Reagan's administration. The Petco strike. Remember the air traffic controllers? Maybe you're too young then. But what happened was, the air traffic controllers said they wanted a raise. Well, Reagan looked at the numbers,
mm-hmm.
and these are federal employees, controllers. Reagan looked at it, and he offered them an 11% raise. Well, they want a lot more money than that. Oh, we have a tough time up in the tower, and we have a, you know, hard job, a lot of stress, and we need a lot more money than that. And as a matter of fact, they had all signed an agreement not to strike, because they were essential personnel, you know,
right.
on our flights and so forth. Well, when 70% of them went on strike, went out, walked mm-hmm. out, Reagan looked at that immediately
right.
and said, that's not the way we do business. He fired
mm-hmm.
them, and he wrote the statement himself. Now,
mm-hmm.
this was a domestic issue, but the world was watching. Because early on, how tough is this cowboy from Hollywood going to be here? You know, what kind of a leader is going to be? Well, let me tell you, Canada closed the refueling base up at Gander in solidarity with the strikers. Reagan said immediately, open it in 2 hours or we'll never land there again. They opened it.
Oh, wow.
and people really took notice of what went on. And, in fact, later, Secretary of State George Shultz made a comment. He said, you know, the statement that Reagan wrote firing the air traffic controllers was the best foreign policy statement he's made to date. And I took his point, you know, point about leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, a small, just a small observation, a small recollection of the way Reagan tried to handle things. He really did. And he was amazing. I mean, he'd step up. It would be tough times, but he had to make a decision, and he did. But the other thing is he called in extremely talented, well-versed, strong advisors. I mean, he had George Shultz. He had Cap Weinberger. He had James Baker. He had really experienced people who knew the world and were giving him their best advice. And I look around the White House today and I say, where are the giants? You know, I mean, where is this guy getting his advice? I mean, I don't even know. And in fact, in his first administration, when he was new, he had a couple of pretty good people in there. He had Robert Gates. He had Leon Panetta, you know, some others who had a lot of experience. Now they're out. And you probably saw, your listeners saw, that they both have come out and blasted Obama's policies on Syria. They absolutely blasted it. And so this is not, you know, Panetta said you stayed a red line. Well, you jolly well better pay attention to it once you make a statement like that if you're a strong country. You know, things of that nature. So I don't know where the giants are, and they certainly aren't in the White House.
Well, one thing that I've said on a previous show, and it actually came from Eric Erickson, but one thing that he said was that A people hire A people, meaning really good people hire great people and, you know, surround themselves with great people. B and C people hire C and D people and surround themselves with people that's not as smart, so it makes the guy at the top look really smart. And I think that's where we're at with Obama. He has hired C and D people, especially in the second term, and look what we've got now. I mean, I don't notice
it's a problem.
You know, anyone that really stands out.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, I hope maybe somebody will come forth and show some backbone here. I really don't know, but I think as we've heard some other commentators say recently, that if people like Gates and Panetta and a few others had been in the White House now more recently, we might not have had all this waffling back and forth and so forth. I mean, it's just been unconscionable, all the stuff that's going on. In fact, I don't know whether I mentioned this when I was on your show before, but when I look around and see what's going on, I mean, I get so depressed I should be on Cymbalta. I know, that's kind of crazy. But and the other thing that I'll make a comment about, do you know that there are 1,221 days. Now, do you have patience to endure 1,221 days from now? That's how much longer President Obama will be occupying our White House.
Well, when you get that Cymbalta, if you'll send
Harry?
Me some, I'll take a look at it. it's rough. But I do want to talk about Castle Bravo also. Congratulations on the success of that book.
We're having a good time on my Kindle.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. But, you know, one thing about Castle Bravo, it really makes you think. And, you know, and I've mentioned to you before that, you know, on September 10th, 2001, we would have never, ever imagined what would have happened the very next day, that terrorists would have taken, you know, United States aircraft, commercial aircraft full of people, used them as missiles and bombs and flew them into highly occupied areas and also into our nation's capital. And, you know, in Castle Bravo, you write not about airplanes, but about a certain
national security threat.
A national security threat.
In fact, I'd like to mention just something new that it was just recently. If any of your listeners like to read thrillers, political thrillers, contemporary thrillers, you know, about the White House, foreign agents, political intrigue, My publisher did just release the first 5 chapters of Castle Bravo, so if they'd like to check it out before they spend any money, you know, they might want to just check it out. What they can do is go to my website, which is my name, karnabodman.com, K-A-R-N-A, and then Bodman, like your bod, B-O-D-M-A-N, karnabodman.com. Just go to the website, and right there in the front, you can just click on the link, and it just says, read the first part of Castle Bravo. You can read it, you know, read the first 5 chapters. And if you read it and you get sort of intrigued and you want to, gee, those characters are kind of interesting, and, wow, I wonder what that plot is, I wonder where that's going, then they might decide that they want to go ahead and read the book, and all the links are right there under the cover art. Or maybe they'll say, well, I'm not sure if that's my cup of tea. Maybe I'll go read Nelson DeMille's book or something like that. But I just wanted to invite them to try it, you know, for free. And, you know, it's a good little marketing ploy, of course, to put a few – to put some pages up there and let people make up their own mind. So that's the book, Castle Bravo, which, by the way, is a title that I stole, to be honest. It was the name of a top-secret government project, which actually plays right into the story, and it was declassified not too long ago, and so when it was, I stole the title, and I used that as the title of the book. It does fit in with the story. So, Castle Bravo... Let me take a moment and tell you the inspiration for the story, okay? Mm-hmm. And tell you how it all came together. And what happened was, sometime back, I had a very interesting conversation with a major general who was head of our entire missile defense agency, worldwide, all our missile defense forces. People know about missile defense. It was one of Reagan's initiatives, of course. Star Wars, if you will. Well, what he said, we had quite a conversation. He said, Karna, let me explain to you, and we might have talked about this on your show before, but maybe for your new listeners. He said, let me explain why we need to expand our missile defenses. Now, we do have some interceptors on the West Coast, nothing on the East Coast. At least recently, this is amazing, Congress has asked for a site survey of possible places to put some intercepts on the East Coast. It's a protective measure for us, which is great. Now, as a sidebar, the only trouble is they also have to file an environmental impact statement. Now, let me ask you, what would be the environmental impact of a missile strike? I wonder if they're going to put that in the report, too. In any event, so the general said to me, look, let me explain why we need more missile defense. Okay, let me paint a scenario. Let's say it's a few years down the road, and let's say that some country doesn't like us, or some militant group or something, they somehow get hold of a small nuclear device. Now, they're all trying, right? I mean, you know, Pakistan,
Heard
them. Okay, and let's also say that they get hold of a delivery vehicle, meaning a missile you could strap it onto and shoot it up in the air. And it could be something as simple as a Scud missile. Well, probably heard the term. In fact, some guy tried to sell a Scud missile on eBay a while back. The FBI caught him. That's pretty crazy. In any event, you can buy those Scud missile, those kinds of components, from a black market arms dealer for about $100,000, actually. So let's say they have these components. And he went on. And let's say they're off in a kind of disguised fishing boat or something off one of our coasts. You never find them. I mean, there's a lot of boats out there. And let's say further that their plan is not to aim it at New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, which would be unbelievable, of course. No, no, no. What they're going to do is they're going to aim it straight up in the air and detonate it, let's say 50 miles up or even more. Mm-hmm. And a Scud can go that far. Okay, now what happens? Well, it doesn't kill you on the ground. That isn't what happens when you detonate a nuclear explosion way, way, way up. No, but what it does, it sets off shock waves. And what those shock waves are called is an electromagnetic pulse. Just picture kind of like microwaves, you know, emanating out of this thing. And what that EMP, that pulse, does, it fries all of the electronics on the ground. So you would have no electricity grid, no computers, no cell phones, no communications of any kind, no sanitation, refrigeration, aviation, transportation. He looked at me and said, Karna, It would set us back to the year 1910. And don't think our enemies aren't looking at it. So I thought, oh boy, you know, I've kind of heard about this a little bit, but I don't know that much about it. And why aren't we paying attention to this kind of a threat? Why not? So I put a story together, and the story is about my heroine, Samantha Reed, works in the White House as head of the White House Office of Homeland Security, and she gets some intel that there are some other countries kind of looking at this research, you know, what would happen in an EMP strike and all that kind of thing. She gets very concerned about it, tries to get the higher-ups interested, and, of course, there's a lot of other threats going on, you know, bureaucratic hassles. Oh, we got too many other things to worry about. That's not going to happen. We can't worry about that today. Kind of like Scarlett O'Hara. I'm not going to worry about that today. I'll worry about that tomorrow. I'm flying out of Gone with the Wind. So in the story, the love of her life is a business guy on the outside, and he happens to be sent overseas to kind of a remote area. He's working in oil and gas projects where one of these EMP things happens by mistake. Now, the question is, does he get out? You know, what happens? You know, don't be too sure. And then meanwhile, where it happens over there, people realize what kind of a weapon this really could be, and then there is a threat against our country. And what are we going to do? How do you stop it? That's the story of Castle Bravo. And I hope people want to read it. There is a lot of intrigue. There's a love story woven in there, but a lot of intrigue, a lot of bureaucratic infighting, that sort of thing, and international plots. It's not Al-Qaeda. I'll tell you that right now.
Right.
It's a little more complicated than that. So I hope people want to read Castle Bravo and find out what happens.
Well, you know, as you said, it's not a far-fetched plot. I mean, this has really been studied by the government. And,
that's right.
You know, and it would set it, like you said, 1910. It would cause just, in addition to, you know, not having transportation and communication, just the sheer...
No electronics whatsoever.
Well, and the sheer psychological impact of it would be devastating.
Well, here's the deal. If you can't communicate, there's no TV, there's no radio, there's no cell phones, there's no telephone, there's nothing, and of course no power. I mean, we have a home in Florida, and people know what it's like. There's hurricanes, and you get prepared, you get water, and all that sort of thing. But my gosh, people have to live for maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks with no power, and it gets pretty darn tough,
right,
you know, on anybody. But then eventually the power is brought back, or they truck in things or so forth. No, that couldn't happen because it doesn't come back. It's fried. It's gone. You have to replace the computers, replace the grid, replace the turbines. And how are you going to do that? We don't have extra ones, extra turbines for the sitting in a closet somewhere. They have to be manufactured, and they make them in Japan. So, I mean, sure, some of the things that we have are hardened, as we say, Air Force One, some military communications. But, hey, what about the rest of us? Really?
Well, sure.
And, in fact, I don't know whether you saw his last season, and I don't know if they're going to bring it back, but there's this kind of crazy over-the-top show on NBC called Revolution.
Right.
And it was kind of over-the-top. But the premise of the show was kind of right out of my book. They should send me royalties. The idea was how would we live many years after electronics are gone? They don't tell you how they're gone in the show, but you see these gangs marauding the countryside, attacking people and taking their water and food and whatever, and people living by candlelight. And so I say, you know, maybe the Amish would survive, but what about thee and me?
Well,
I don't know.
I guess we'd go up to Pennsylvania and find out and take some lessons from them, I guess.
It's a heck of an argument to have a gun and protect yourself, I guess. You know, that's a concealed carry. It would be a pretty good idea. But in any event, that's the story of Castle Bravo. And I have four books out. That is the fourth. And I hope that your listeners might want to check it out. It's on Amazon. In fact, it's available in print. The hardback is sold out, but it's got trade paperback, or you can get it on audio or on a Kindle. Or Nook, or whatever you might have, or, you know, check Amazon, or check the website, karnabodman.com. That'd be great. And if anybody wants to, something else that I love to do, and that is if anybody does want to check out the website, there's a place where it says contact, you know, usually contact the person. and they want to send me an email there through the website, I'd be delighted to send them an autographed book plate. You know, these are paper book plates, you know, that I would autograph for them, and then they stick them inside the book, and you've got an autographed book, say, for a gift or something like that.
Oh, sure.
Or for yourself. So
yeah, that sounds like a great idea for our listeners out there.
Sure.
I'm sure that they would be very interested in that.
So the point is, our government should be paying attention to this stuff. They're not. We had an EMP commission, and they testified before Congress several years ago and said, here's all the things we ought to be doing. You know, harden the grid, do all these things. And they said, okay, that's nice. Thank you very much. They filed a report. They're not going to spend any money. They didn't do anything, and there you are.
You know, one thing that I've seen that, you know, unfortunately, as a nation, sometimes we learn the hard way, and I hope, you know, something like this, that on this it would be too late if we learn the hard way. It would set us back. You know, it seemed like the Middle Ages, you know.
Well, that's right. Now, we have, our government has developed, our military contractors, has developed some what we call e-weapons, meaning, you know, electronic, not using nuclear material, but sort of imitating that on a much smaller scale. But it works, and I just hope nobody else has them, but you can be darn sure they're researching them. The Russians and the Chinese are researching them right now, as far as I've heard. For example, they have one that they developed a few months ago where what they did was they filled up kind of a warehouse building or something with a whole bunch of computers, older computers, and set up some TV cameras to kind of take pictures of what was going on. And then they have this e-weapon that they put on, just think of it as kind of on a drone or a missile or something. They fly it over and then aim it at the building. You know, they're not killing people or anything. It's just an electronic thing. And then when it was over, they went in and all the computers were fried. You couldn't plug them in again. You couldn't. They're dead. They're gone. And that's exactly the way things work. And so you just wonder if somebody gets a hold of something. What if they flew it over the New York Stock Exchange or something?
Oh, that would be devastating.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So why aren't we paying attention? That's why I'm writing these books, Aaron. I try to call attention to some of these national security problems, but I want to weave them into a pretty good mystery or thriller so people have a good time reading a book, you know.
Oh, sure.
That's what a lot of thriller writers are doing. They're saying, hey, I'm calling attention to this, you know, pay attention, but here's a good story. Because I remember I might have shared one of my favorite quotes with you, and that is from George Bernard Shaw. He said, the best way to get your point across is to entertain. That's what I'm trying to do.
Right.
Entertain.
Well, what are the chances that we do have these somewhere around in the event that, I mean, surely we're not asleep at the switch. Maybe we are, but I'd like to think we're not. That we have these spread out somewhere secretly, and you know, we're not telling anyone. So if this does happen to us, we can be proactive and take advantage of it before it happens to us.
Well, those kinds of weapons are the kind of thing you would use against something else. They're not protective of us. You see, that's what I was saying. What we need is to protect ourselves from anybody else having those kinds of weapons with things like, well, as I said, hardening things, Faraday cages, that's something that does protect, you know, certain things.
Right.
I mean, the e-weapons, for example, are the kind of thing that, that we used a small one at the beginning of the Iraq War because we knocked out Saddam's military communications.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Little things like that. But, I just think it's a very scary scenario. And I just would pray that, first of all, to protect ourselves, as I said, a good missile defense system is a heck of a start.
Right.
To put some interceptors, you know, along the East Coast like we have on the West Coast already by Santa Barbara and Fort Greely, Alaska, and so forth. But if we have them, then if there were any kind of an incoming missile of some sort, Lord knows what would be on it or how it would work, but then we would have interceptors to shoot it down. That's what you got them there for, to protect us. And they keep cutting the budget, you know, for missile defense. It used to be $9 or $10 billion, which is not a lot in a $500 billion budget. But they've cut it back to 7.5, which is, you know, really small when you consider the whole defense budget. It's really a shame.
Well, you know, if a nuclear weapon did explode above a U.S. city, you know, even back in like where you got the name from the book, Castle Bravo, and that top secret operation, there was fallout into the ocean of radioactive material, and a Japanese fishing boat came in contact of it and got ill, and that's how the Japanese did study on it to see, you know, that if this the bomb that exploded did make these people sick. So not only would we have to worry about this electromagnetic pulse and not having communications or equipment, then we have to worry about the fallout of this coming down onto a U.S. city and then causing, you know...
Eventually. Eventually. And you're right about what you just said, because what happened there with the Japanese fishing boat, it was called the Lucky Dragon, and it happened back in the... way back after World War II, and we did atmospheric testing out in the Marshall Islands. And I would say that was unluckiest time of all for those fishermen. They were out there. We didn't, I guess, realize they were there. They kind of got into the area. They shouldn't have been there. And we ended up paying Japan $2 million to try to treat them. And back then, I mean, that was a lot of money to try to treat them for radiation sickness, but it was a real tragedy. So, those things do happen. We don't do atmospheric testing anymore, of course.
Anyway,
that happened way, way back then. No, you know, you're right. We just need to pay attention to some of these things, and I just hope that we do. I don't want to cut the defense budget any more than we already have, and I'm worried that this current administration, that's what they want to do.
Well, hopefully, like I said, we won't learn the hard way, but thank you so much for coming on our show. I want our listeners
Absolutely.
To go to KarnaBodman.com. And I think you said the first five chapters they can read of Castle Bravo?
Absolutely. Go to the website, and there they are. And it'd really be sort of fun if they would like to take a look. And they can just read them for free. First five chapters are right there, karnabobman.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. You're a great friend of the show.
Thank you, Aaron.
And have a great rest of the night.
You got it. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Karna Bodman, and a former White House aide to President Ronald Reagan. She was the deputy press secretary, and then also went and became spokesman for the National Security Council, and also director of that organization as well. We will be right back after news. Stay with us. We're going to talk about Syria, Iran, a little bit of Iraq even, and then about Russia and Putin. Stay tuned.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Ron Flatter. Admitting he has a big arsenal of chemical weapons, Syrian President Bashar Assad said he will abide by the agreement to surrender them.
We don't have any condition to send it anywhere. At the end, if it's going to be destroyed, it could be destroyed anywhere. It's, as I said, it's very detrimental to the environment. So whoever country is ready to take the risk of those materials, let them take it.
In an exclusive interview recorded yesterday in Damascus with Fox News, Assad estimated it would cost $1 billion to safely get rid of the chemical weapons, which he said his forces did not use near Damascus. Assad called out President Obama for saying that Syria ever denied having chemical weapons.
We always say it's classified issue, we don't have to discuss it. And if you want to talk about it, we say if, and if means you may have it, you may not. So this is blatant lie.
Assad says that before Syria signed on to the UN ban on chemical weapons, his country's stockpile was a classified matter. Monday's massacre at the Washington Navy Yard has Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel promising tighter security checks.
Where there are gaps, we will close them. Where there are inadequacies, we will address them. And where there are failures, we will correct them.
Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis was undergoing mental health treatment through the Veterans Administration, but still had his security clearance. Fox News Radio's Rich Johnson, Washington. What was it Ben Bernanke said that sent the Dow to a record high close?
The committee decided to await more evidence that the recovery's progress will be sustained before adjusting the pace of asset purchases.
And the outgoing Federal Reserve chairman saying the bond-buying support the economy has been leaning on won't go away yet, so the Dow rose 147 points. Former heavyweight boxing champion Ken Norton has died at age 70. Norton famously broke Muhammad Ali's jaw in a fight 40 years ago. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
Fox News Early Prime, breaking down business news and its impact on your bottom line. Your World with Neil Cavuto.
That's how I do business. That's why I am this.
Bold positions and brash opinions on the topics America is buzzing about. The Five.
How do you think this will set in with the American people?
This will be the pulse of the nation.
Washington insight and political know-how from the best in the Beltway. Special report with Brett Baer.
The epicenter of the political world is here.
The number one place for fair and balanced coverage. Fox News Channel.
What's wrong with working hard to make our lives and our kids' lives better? Nothing. At Fox Business, we don't have a problem with success. We have a very big problem with those who get in the way of it. We don't come out of the box bashing those who make money, just the politicians stealing it and the bureaucracy wasting it. We're not just sitting behind a desk. We're out in the field, on the floor, with the folks. Because when a story moves forward, so do we.
Fox Business, the power to prosper. Check your local listings.
The number of confirmed deaths in the Colorado floods remains at 6, but another number is falling.
While there are still people who are unaccounted for, there are others in mountain towns that have been cut off who just want to stay put. Mitch Utterback is a lieutenant colonel with the National Guard.
The helicopters are launching to continue their assessment of the entire county. We only got a few people yesterday. They're going up right now to also just be up there in case somebody makes a last-minute decision that it's time to go.
He says in Boulder County alone, they've rescued nearly 1,200 people by air and 700 using ground transportation. In Boulder County, Jessica Rosenthal, Fox News Radio.
House Speaker John Boehner says a vote is coming on a continuing spending resolution.
This week, the House will pass a CR that locks the sequester savings in and defunds Obamacare.
The president says Republicans aren't stopping at this month's spending deadline.
You have never seen in the history of the United States the debt ceiling or the threat of not raising the debt ceiling being used to extort a president.
The debt limit is expected to be reached in mid-October. Climate change skeptics have been fueled by a new report.
The big issue in the global warming debate is how large is the human impact on climate? And this report shows that it's very small.
Joseph Bast of the Heartland Institute. Later this month, the United Nations will release its report on climate change. Leaked drafts show surface temperature increases have been insignificant for the last 15 years and that sea ice is increasing, not decreasing. Republicans today grilled administration officials about the economic consequences of the president's climate action plan. But Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz told panelists
the threat from climate change is real and urgent.
Today's report finds a historical record of disasters equal in intensity and frequency to today's. In Washington, Doug McElway, Fox News Radio. Crude oil went up nearly $3 a barrel. I'm Ron Flatter, Fox News Radio.
A colorless landscape. The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope, bringing the nation back, one photo at a time. This is Aaron McGrady.
Welcome back to the program. If you are just joining us, you missed former Reagan top aide Karna Bodman. She was also deputy press secretary for the president and then went over to the National Security Council and was the director of that and then also a spokeswoman for that. But you missed her. My thanks to Karna Bodman. Go to karnabodman.com, K-A-R-N-A-B-O-D-M-A-N. .com, and you can read the first five chapters of her book, Castle Bravo, a political thriller, and that will really scare you to death, some of the scenarios that are laid out. And again, like I mentioned with Karna, right before 9/11, we would have never thought that someone would have used planes to fly them full of people, full of fuel, use them as missiles into the World Trade Center, and also into the Pentagon, and also aiming for either the Capitol or the White House, and killing over 3,000 people. We would have never expected that. But then, on September 12th, the day after 9/11, we thought otherwise. And in Karna's book, she lays out a scenario where, maybe we don't – something that we don't think about, but it has been studied by the government, and a situation that a terrorist group or even a foreign nation explodes a nuclear-equipped missile, you know, like you said, you can buy it from $100,000, some of these missiles, and put a nuclear device in there and explode it, and the pulse would fry all the electrical systems in your car, in airplanes, computers, the electric grid, but something to think about. So go to CardinalBodman.com, check out her book, read the first 5 chapters, and then you can also request a signed nameplate for your copy of her book, Castle Bravo. But one thing I want to talk about, you know, we've got this situation in Syria right now, and the United States and Russia came to an agreement on Syria, and I'm going to play you what our Secretary of State John Kerry said when we reached this agreement, and we'll discuss this right after.
The United States and Russia are committed to the elimination of Syrian chemical weapons in the soonest and safest manner. We agreed that Syria must submit within a week, not in 30 days, but in 1 week, a comprehensive listing, and additional details will be addressed regarding that in the coming days. That to accomplish our goal, this plan had to produce transparency, accountability, timeliness, and enforceability. It must be credible and verifiable. If fully implemented, we believe it can meet these standards. The world will now expect the Assad regime to live up to its public commitments. And as I said at the outset of these negotiations, there can be no games, no room for avoidance, or anything less than full compliance by the Assad regime. If we can join together and make this framework a success and eliminate Syria's chemical weapons, we would not only save lives, but we would reduce the threat to the region and reinforce an international standard, an international norm. We could also lay the groundwork for further cooperation that is essential to end the bloodshed that has consumed Syria for more than 2 years.
You know, one question I have for the Secretary of State is, you know, putting this into a historical context. In the Syria uprising, and their civil war has been going on since March 2011. But since March 2011, and the figures I have here actually are much, much greater. But this stopped, I believe, in either March or April when the cutoff of this report was. But the estimated death toll was 70,000 in Syria. The population of Syria is 22,530,000. That's only 0.3% of the percentage. And I say only. I don't mean to make it to light. But that's about 3,000 deaths per month. But if you look at the United States Civil War, that lasted 4 years, 1 month. The average number of deaths per month, the Syria uprising is 3,000. In the American Civil War, it was 12,617. 618,000 people died, and that was close to 2%, actually 1.66% of the U.S. population. We have the Libyan Civil War back in 2011. That only lasted 8 months, but 3,750 people on average each month died. 30,000 in Libya died there, but you know, that puts it in perspective a little bit. And, you know, I said I was torn if we should have went into Syria and if we should not have. And I came to the conclusion that we should not go into Syria, even as a missile strike, because if we were to free the people from that regime and the people that, you know, so horribly got gassed by Syrian gas, would they really appreciate it? Would they appreciate our efforts afterwards? Look in Iraq. We freed that country, but then, and when we freed that country, you saw them tearing down Saddam Hussein's statues, parades in the streets, people flying American flags. But then, what happened after the nostalgia wore off? We had attacks against us. It was just bad. And, you know, I think about that, what happened after Iraq. And, you know, not all Iraqis were like that to us, I know. But would Syria really appreciate our efforts? And should we send men and women into Syria? And I know they said no boots on the ground, but what happened if a plane got shot down in Syria? We'd have to go rescue our pilot. But would they really, you know, show gratitude towards us? And I don't think they would. So I really don't think that we should go into Syria. And then, so fast forward to present day, and the United States and Russia enter an agreement with Syria. And how this happened, if you haven't done research or haven't been listening to the news or have been living under a rock, Russia actually took the lead on this. And in the way and the manner that they did this really hurt Barack Obama, hurt the United States, made Barack Obama look like, you know, just a mere child. And, you know, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, I've called him a thug before, and I'll call him a thug now, and that's what he is. He's a former KGB agent. And if you don't know what KGB is, that's similar to the United States CIA. But how he acts and how he treats his people is very thuggish. He tries to repress human rights. He wants Russia really to turn back into the Soviet Union again. And, you know, he took the lead on this, and we showed no leadership at all, no leadership at all in the Syrian crisis. Yeah. For example, John Kerry, he said that if Syria gave up all their chemical weapons, we would not attack Syria by shooting missiles. And shortly after that statement, he started backpedaling because the president was so gung-ho on shooting missiles over into Syria. Well, what did Vladimir Putin do? He took what John Kerry said, and he's like, let's try that. And now look, here we are with an agreement with Russia and Syria for them to not use their chemical weapons, that they will destroy those. Then you listen, if you heard, and I wish I had clips of it. It happened so recently, but I don't have clips, unfortunately, of the interview on Fox News. But you listen to Assad, and that's the president of Syria, if you're not familiar. But you listen to the president of Syria, and the way he talks, and you really have to read between the lines. I'm going to give you an example here. I'm going to play a little clip, and this is back when he was being interviewed by Charlie Rose, and he was talking about the region of Syria. He wasn't talking about the country. He was talking about the region. Listen to this, and I'm going to explain what I mean here in just 1 second.
The president is prepared to strike, and perhaps we'll get the authorization of Congress or not. The question then is, would you give up chemical weapons if it would prevent the president from authorizing a strike? If that is a deal you would accept.
Again, you always imply that we have chemical weapons.
I have to, because that's the assumption of the president.
Yeah.
That is his assumption, and he is the one who will order the strike.
It's his problem if he has an assumption. But for us in Syria, we have principles. We'd do anything to prevent the region from another crazy war. It's not only Syria, because it will start in Syria.
You'll do anything to prevent
the region
having another crazy war.
Yes.
You recognize the consequences for you if there is a strike.
It's not about me. It's about the region.
Well, first of all, let's back. And Charlie Rose asked him about chemical weapons, and he said, that's assuming I have chemical weapons. Well, he just admitted today that he had and has chemical weapons. This guy is nothing but he's like Saddam Hussein in what he says. And then you also talk about the region. He's talking about the region, not if we attacked Syria, not Syria itself. The region could include terrorists. It could include other countries. What would have happened to us if we would have shot missiles into Syria? Maybe Syria wouldn't have done anything, but a crazy war, he said, a crazy war with Syria, with the region, other countries, other terrorists. And then we had Russia come in and save the day. And that is just humiliating for the United States. The United States used to be a world power, and we still are to some extent, and we need to be. But we used to be the one that the world used to look to for guidance and leadership. And who will save the day when the defenseless and other countries can't do anything for themselves or can't speak for themselves? You could always count on America to come in and try to solve the problem. But what happens? Russia, the thuggish government of Russia, in such a desperate attempt to be a world player, looks like the hero. Putin looks like the statesman. And Obama, unfortunately, now I'm no fan of Obama. We all know that. But I always, always, no matter who's in the White House, want the American president to be successful. Because our country is much bigger than one person or one president, one citizen. And Obama was not successful. He was ran over by Putin. He seemed very wishy-washy in what he wanted to do with Syria. And now we have an agreement. We came into similar agreements with Saddam Hussein. And it never really worked out. I don't think it's going to work with Assad. So, time will tell, I guess. Time will tell. We have actually run out of time. We haven't got into everything that I really wanted to talk about. But one thing that I want to encourage you to do as we end the show is make sure you take part in the democratic process. Make sure that you are informed on the issues. Don't take my word for it. Do your research. Don't take Karna Bodman's word for it. Do the research. Don't take Obama. Don't take Democrats, Republicans' word for it. Do the research. Become an educated voter. That's the only way we'll become a great nation once again. And we are still a great nation. But we need to come back to the glory days. Again, it's been a great pleasure and privilege to be with you tonight. Special thanks also to Karna Bodman. Go to karnabodman.com and read the first 5 chapters of Castle Bravo, a fascinating book. Thank you once again, and we will see you next time.